This is Lars. Thanks again for checking out my podcast. Enjoy your day and the show, and let's make America great again. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome to Conspiracy Theory Thursday on the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and we'll deliver some honestly provocative talk for the United States. And if you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's easy to do. 866-HEY-LARS. And naysayers go to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. And there is a lot to talk about. Believe me, we will get to that Supreme Court decision that has done so much to reinforce the God-given rights we have under the Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. But give me a moment. We're going to get to that in just a while. If you leave or forget your child in a hot car and that child dies, should you face some kind of penalty, maybe even the maximum penalty? Should you face a capital penalty for manslaughter? The U.S. Supreme Court has struck down a New York law that barred most people from being able to get a permit to carry a handgun in public. Do your Second Amendment rights extend outside your front door, or do they only extend to the inside of your house? Well, the Supreme Court has decided that issue. Thank God. And thank God for Donald Trump's three picks on the U.S. Supreme Court. What does that mean for the future of the Second Amendment? We'll get into that as well. Has Joe Biden's Government Accountability Office thrown accountability right out the window? We're going to talk about that as well. And I want you to take a moment, if you can take a moment, to cast a vote in our Twitter poll. We put up a brand new question every single day from the news of the day, and then we let you comment on it. And I tell you how I would vote. You'll find it on Twitter, at Lars Larson Show. And if you don't like Twitter, go to my website at LarsLarson.com. Vote counts the same. Should elected county sheriffs refuse to enforce so-called red flag laws? Now, a red flag law is where somebody believes that you're a little bit on the crazy side, might do something horrible and dangerous and deadly. So they go to a judge and they ask the judge, will you tell the police to go and take this man or woman's guns away? And don't give them a chance to have their say said. Don't give them due process. That's how red flag laws work. That's exactly what some states, a minority of states, have actually passed already. And now the U.S. Congress, in this bill that some Republicans in the Senate have sold out on, they want to pressure the states and say, you only get this federal money if you'll pass a red flag law. Even though anybody who looks at red flag laws understands they can't possibly work the way they're designed to work unless you violate people's due process rights. Well, down in New Mexico, in the sheriff, county of Cibola, Sheriff Tony Mace has already said, if somebody hasn't committed a crime, you can't take their personal property. He says he won't enforce that law. So I'm going to ask, should elected county sheriffs around America refuse to enforce red flag laws? Is it part of the job of a sheriff to simply enforce any law that is passed by their county, by their city, or not city, but by their state or by the Congress? Or does a sheriff have an affirmative responsibility that when he takes an oath to protect and defend the Constitution of the U.S., if he finds a law is going to violate the civil rights of some of the people in his county where he or she is elected as the sheriff, is it part of the sheriff's job as that man or woman who took the oath to say, I will not enforce that unconstitutional law? I'd say, yeah, it is part of his job. So you can vote in the Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show or at LarsLarson.com. Always brought to you by AMAC, the Association of Mature American Citizens. AMAC has the conservative values I believe in, so I joined a long time ago. You can too. Just go to amac.us or call 888-262-2006. AMAC is better. Better for you and better for America. Now, yesterday, I asked you about the crazy new policy in Chicago where they have told the police, in many cases, if a criminal runs away, don't chase the criminal on foot. I said, that's wrong. Cops should not be barred from chasing criminals who run away on foot. 96% of you agreed with me. Only 4%, even for a Twitter poll, that's a very small number of people saying yes, but you would all make great naysayers. I'd love to have somebody say, no, the police should not chase you, not on foot, not in a car, not in any other way. In any case, glad to have you with me. If you want to join the conversation, it's 866-439-5277. And I hold to my promise of 25 years. If you're a naysayer, we put you right to the head of the line. And a shout out to our friends in Fort Rucker, Alabama, where they listen to great talk radio on WDBT. That's FM 1039. And you can find my show there Monday through Friday. Now, what exactly does it mean that the U.S. Supreme Court has said to New York that you cannot say to citizens, if you'd like to have a permit to carry a gun? I actually wish we'd all go to constitutional carry. And quite a number of American states have gone to that. Constitutional carry means that if you're legally qualified to own the gun, you're not a convicted felon, you haven't committed domestic violence, and a judge has not sent you to the loony bin, then you're able to carry a gun. You don't need a card or a permit from the government. Your permit is the U.S. Constitution. I completely agree with that. I'll tell you what, because we've got a naysayer, I'm going to go ahead and take the naysayer. What do you say? Let's start with Steve. Steve, if you're a naysayer, you must disagree with me on something. What is it? Let's get right to it.
I do. Although I agree with your stance on gun laws and stuff, I disagree with the notion that a sheriff should not enforce a law because he believes it's unconstitutional. And the reason why is he has a duty to first uphold the law and Constitution as it is written and documented. Secondly, we have a body that is appointed, elected, and so on that interprets whether something is constitutional or not, and the sheriff is not qualified or appointed to interpret constitutional law.
So what does that mean when he takes the oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States?
Well, you know, there's some things that are obvious. I mean, but it all, I think at the end of the day, all laws are supposed to be applied based on their cohesiveness with the Constitution.
Can I try this another way? I haven't been in the military. Have you been in the military, Steve?
I have, and I have not been asked to no longer defend the Constitution.
Well, but I'm going to go a different direction. When you were in the military, if a superior officer gave you an order, you followed the order, right?
Yes.
Is there ever an exception to that?
If the order is knowingly unlawful.
But now, hold on. But when you were in the military, were you a lawyer?
No. There are some things that you know are unlawful, right?
That's what I'm talking about. If you were given an order, if your superior officer said, "See that guy over there? Put a bullet in his head." And you said, "That guy hasn't, you know, he's not an enemy combatant. If I kill him, it's murder." You, as a soldier, even as a private, were expected to interpret that order and say, "Sir, that is an unlawful order. I will not do it," right?
Correct.
Now,
that,
even though,
that
even
is
though,
clearly written. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that you weren't a lawyer. You weren't a legal expert. You might have been a PFC. But if your commanding officer made an illegal order and you determined it was illegal, you didn't do it. And that's what I'm suggesting sheriffs do. Look at this and say, that's a clearly unconstitutional law. I'm not going to follow it. Steve, thanks very much. I appreciate the call. Good naysayer. Coming up, we will talk about that law in New York. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And to tell you that I was pleased when I heard the Supreme Court's decision today. Not surprised, but pleased, because I think the decision to say to New York City, you have no business telling citizens in your state, in New York State, that they must prove they need to exercise their right to keep and bear arms, that is simply out of line. And now, of course, the left, They're losing their minds over this. And because I'm going to be talking to Brad Jacob, who's a teacher of constitutional law and foundations of law at Regent University School of Law. Brad, welcome to the program. And I'll offer up the following evidence, Your Honor, in aid of my objection that the left is losing its mind. The great Keith Oberman has been quoted today as saying it has become necessary to dissolve the Supreme Court of the United States as a result of this ruling. And with that in mind, where are we going next after this great decision from six justices?
Well, I guess we're going into hyperbole land is where we're going. Today's decision is actually pretty limited. I mean, it's a good result for gun rights, but the court is not addressing all the open questions that have been open since it decided the Heller case from D.C., the McDonald case from Chicago. There have been all sorts of questions about what weapons can the government forbid without violating the Second Amendment? And what restrictions can they put on it? And what about red flag laws and all these different things? None of that got resolved today. The court simply answered a very narrow question, which is, if the government tells you that your ability to carry your firearm outside of your home depends on a discretionary approval by some government person who has no standard to work under, they just get to decide, that that violates the Second Amendment. And so for the court to have upheld this New York law would have been almost unbelievable.
Well, and Professor Jacob, let me ask you something, because I've been covering courts and cops for a long time, but as I said, I'm not a lawyer. And by the way, I'm glad I don't have to get a permit to do a talk show or to exercise my First Amendment. And I'm glad that I don't have to show that I need to do it, because I've got a lot of liberals in the audience who would say, he doesn't need to say that stuff. Don't give him a permit. But having said that, I know that the courts usually decide, you know, the question in front of them. They can, and they can be incredibly constrained. They can say, we're going to decide it based on this angel that's dancing on the head of a pin. And they can do it that narrow, but they can also be broader. Could they have broadened this out and said, we're going to decide this, even though the question in front of them was, how are these people in New York State being treated?
I'm not sure. It probably would have been what we call dicta if they had started saying broader things about the Second Amendment, because you're just a little bit more skeptical when a court decides a question that it didn't really have in front of it. When, I mean, that's kind of what Roe versus Wade did, right? Was laying down all this framework about trimesters and this and that and the other thing that wasn't necessary to decide its case. Because the facts of this New York case were so specific and so unusual, there was no reason for the court to go broader. Sooner or later, they're going to have to. They're going to have to tell us what kinds of weapons can be banned. You know, nuclear warheads, probably. AR-15s, maybe not. Those kinds of questions. But this one, you know, dealt with this such a very specific issue. And the court even indicated that in the 43 states that are what they call must issue or shall issue states, which is to say you comply with the rules of the process, they have to give you a permit. The court even said there can be process. They can do background checks. They can make sure you don't have, something going on with your mental health. They can have a process before they issue the permit. They right. simply can't have it be totally discretionary.
Well, and I always admit my audience, if I have a dog in the fight, although the PETA folks don't like it when I say that, I have a permit. I carry a gun when I'm away from my home, unless I'm going to the airport or a federal building. So I understand, and they can make, but somebody brought up a point to me today, a caller, and he raised a legitimate concern, and that is, can they make it overly onerous to get the permit? And I thought the New York requirement that you had to prove to some bureaucrat that you had a need to carry a gun. So, you know, you got these diamond merchants that are carrying $1 million worth of ice in a briefcase. You say, well, I've got a need. And they say, not until you've been attacked. I mean, in other words, they set the bar very high. Washington, D.C., for example, you can get a carry permit, but the best estimates by a young lady who actually did it were a year and a couple of $1,000. And you haven't even bought the gun at that point. You're just getting the permit. Can New York and these other seven states that don't have shall issue, can they say, okay, you can get a permit, but it's going to cost you $5,000 in several years, and we're going to make it so hard that nobody's even going to want to ask? Or would that be violating the spirit of this ruling?
That goes beyond what this case was about. I don't think there's any doubt that if a state put a $5,000 application fee on the permit, the court would find that's a violation of the Second Amendment, just as if they ask for $5,000 to go stand in front of City Hall and make a speech, they would violate your First Amendment rights. Again, there's going to be some level of reasonableness here. Can there be a process that reasonably makes sure that people who are crazy, who are violent, who shouldn't have guns, aren't getting them? Yes. But if it takes a huge amount of time or costs a huge amount of money, I think we're just going to be right back in court again, and this Supreme Court is not going to have any part of that.
Professor Jacob, the other thing I'm inclined to ask is, you got this crazy, I think it's a crazy bill in front of the Congress right now, and you got a bunch of sellout rhinos in the Senate that have said they'll vote for it. And it's really, I mean, compared to all the stuff they say they want, it's pretty mild by comparison, but I think it goes too far. They want to push states to pass red flag laws, which I think violate due process. But the other thing they've kind of suggested is, well, with 18 to 21-year-olds, we want you to take a look at their criminal background, which in many cases is sealed records. And we want to look at their mental health background, which if it goes beyond, you know, the standard now is if a judge has sent you the loony bin for a certain number of days by court order, then you're too crazy for a gun. If not, if you're just seeing a counselor, or, you know, taking antidepressants or being treated for PTSD, then that doesn't count. They're really talking about getting into people's lives in very intrusive and in ways that seem to violate current federal law, aren't they?
I think so. You know, Lars, these are hard questions, right? Where everybody's fed up with the violence that goes on in this country, and people are scrambling to try to find responses. And for me, the most positive thing is when people are at least having a conversation, when people are sitting down and saying, okay, well, I can't agree with that, but I could give you on this one. And so I'm generally in favor of the people in Congress trying to see if they can reach a common ground that they can all agree on. You know, none of this is going to make everybody happy on either side, and some of this is so cultural. You know, I live in Virginia. You won't find many people around here who think that nobody should have guns, right? That's just the I'm you know, because I don't have an arsenal in my home. I'm sort of an outlier here in Virginia, but of course in other parts of the country, people think it's insane to even own a gun and can't imagine why you'd want to do it. So I would like to see the Supreme Court telling us what the actual parameters of the Second Amendment are and what the government can do without violating that. And then I'd like to let the political people try to behave like grown-ups and work out things to keep schools safer. And maybe that's metal detectors, maybe that's psychological testing. I don't know what it is, but
Professor, you're talking to the wrong guy. I want every teacher who wants to carry a concealed weapon to be able to carry one. And some in Texas, some school districts do, and they don't get attacked. And some in Missouri do, and several other states. I have a feeling. You notice my friend John Lott, who was an economics professor. He runs a crime prevention research center now. And he says 94 to 95% of mass shootings happen in gun-free zones. You say, wow, what a statistic. And what are they trying to turn the schools into? Gun-free zones. And you say, well, does that seem sensible since most of the bad things happen in gun-free zones? Professor Jacob, it's a pleasure to have you on. That's Professor Brad Jacob from Regent University School of Law. I can see a lot of people want to sound off. We'll get to those calls in a moment. And if you let your kid die in a hot car, should you get the death penalty? We'll talk about that, too, up next. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I want to point something out to you. I got an email yesterday from a listener who said, listen, if you leave your kid in a hot car and the child dies, you should get the death penalty. Now, I don't think an awful lot of states are willing to enforce the death penalty, although it's a perfectly acceptable way of taking on people who are murderers, people who murder deliberately. Would I vote for a measure if I got the chance to vote on it in favor of giving the death penalty to a parent who leaves a child in the car, in a car, and dies? It is only, today is the second official day of summer, so it's still starting to get hot in many parts of the country. I know some of you are in hot areas already, but we're not even in the middle of summer yet. We have had six kids die so far. A five-year-old died after being left in a vehicle in Houston as his mother prepared for a birthday party and temperatures outside hit 100 degrees. Outrageous. They were getting ready to celebrate his eight-year-old sister's birthday. He dies in the car. And a three-month-old boy died after being left in his parents' car for several hours. The infant was left in a minivan in Pennsylvania. Outside temperatures hit 92, which means inside that car could have been 120, 130. It could be ridiculous temperatures to have a child die in any way because the negligence of a parent is terrible. To have a child die in that way is especially horrifying. Would you go for the death penalty for a parent who is that negligent and causes the death of a child? I'd vote for it. Yeah, I would. Do I think the most Americans would? Probably not. Let's go to Pete. Pete, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Hey, thank you. So I'm calling. I make a comment about the last naysayer that just called you.
Yeah.
In regard to the cops that say, hey, if I see a law that is not good, I'm not going to. I just gotta go by the law. I just gotta go by the law. This gentleman, he should look at what just happened in Texas, because your cops ready to go and save those children.
Yep.
And what did they do?
Nothing.
Well, the boss said not to do it. I mean, we are, Lars, are we this stupid? Question. Are
I hope
we
not.
This stupid?
I hope, and Pete, you make a great point, because think about this, not just fiction. Fiction is full of stories of the man or woman who says, I don't care what I'm being told to do, I'm going to go do the right thing. We think of that in the right circumstances as heroic. And I know I'm going to date myself a little bit, but I was a kid when Vietnam was ending. But during Vietnam, there was the infamous My Lai massacre, where American service members were told, you know, kill everybody in this village. And the order was an illegal order, but it doesn't do you any good to call it out as illegal after the fact. You have to have the courage and the discussion at the time, because I remember Lieutenant William Calley, you know, being in court on that. And they said, every service member knows you've got to follow the orders of your commander, unless the day comes when your commander gives you an illegal order, in which case you need to say, sir, I'm not going to follow that order because it's an illegal order, even though who's a lawyer out there? If you know, the average PFC, the average sergeant, the average corporal,
exactly.
You know, that you say, sir,
exactly.
I'm not going to follow that order. It's an illegal order. And you have to have the guts to do something that every bit of you as a military member says, I can't fail to follow a superior officer's order. Yes, you can. And in some cases, you are expected to, right?
Exactly. I'm a father and a grandfather, all right? And when I heard what happened to those children over there, I cried, even though I'm 62 years old.
I'm not
you
surprised.
Understand what I'm talking about?
I know. And Pete, what about the cop? I talked about him earlier this week. The cop got the call from his wife, and she said, I've been shot. She was at Uvalde. I've been shot. I'm dying. She thought, and she did die. I mean, but she knew that she'd been hit so badly that she was dying, and she called her husband, an off-duty cop, for help. He grabbed a gun and ran right over there. And what did the other cops do? They stopped him from going in to try to save her and every kid he could save. And so maybe those cops should have said, I don't care what this guy who's now been put on leave, Pedro, the police chief for Uvalde, he's saying don't go in. Somebody should, and if he's incompetent and he's your boss, at some point you say, you know what, boss, to hell with you. I'm going in. It's the right thing to do, and take the consequences. Maybe you lose your job, but maybe you save some lives.
Absolutely. You save some lives. Hey, is this book that I'm reading, it says that you see good and you don't do what is good. Guess what? It says that you're sinning.
Yeah.
You know, and in this case, people can die on our watch, because even if I'm not a doctor, but I know how to perform CPR, do I help somebody on the side of the road? Of course I do.
Of course you do. And in fact, I'm glad we've got Good Samaritan laws. Pete, one other reference. Do you recognize the phrase, I was just following orders?
Man, that's why I left Romania. Because
yeah.
I didn't want to follow orders, Lars.
I couldn't agree with you more. Pete, it is a pleasure. Thank you so much for the call. Let's go to Dwayne. Hey, Dwayne, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars. Well, you had a caller on there earlier that was talking about the kids in schools and stuff, and how they're kind of being pushed through and stuff and being ignored.
Socially promoted. Yep.
Yeah. Well, my son, that exact same thing happened. He was about 2 weeks away from graduating, and he had straight Fs, and went to the parent teacher conference, and they said, oh yeah, straight Fs, you know, and then miraculously in the last 2 weeks, they found some extra points and he got straight Ds, and they pushed him through, but that should have never happened. But my point is, in the administration or the superintendent or the governor or somebody, there are kids out there that are in this situation, and you're probably the same age as me, Lars. I graduated in 76.
I was 77.
Okay, that's pretty close. But there used to be classes when I went to school where there was help for kids that maybe weren't quite as fast a learner or something as the rest.
Yep.
And it really helped these kids out. Well, the state, because of cuts or whatever, has eliminated those. And now there's these kids that need help, in my opinion. And these are the shooters out there. These are the kids that need help. And that, in my opinion, is why these kids are shooting. They need help, and nobody's helping them.
And, you know, Duane, the other thing I'd add to this, because I've noticed about 20 years ago, there was somebody who wrote a long piece about little boys in elementary and middle schools. And they pointed out very few men teach at all. 22% of teachers in America are men, and very few of them in elementary and middle schools. And they say a lot of these kids are coming from single female head of household families, which is admirable that a single mom is trying to do it on her own. Now, do I think she'd be better if she had a father for her child in the home? Yes. But lacking that, since I'm not going to have the government mandate that, at the very least, the schools can say, let's assign more male teachers, especially for the elementary and the middle schools, and let's get some male influence on those kids. If they don't have it at home, at the very least, the schools could provide it at school. And I appreciate the call. Hey, does the current nationwide shortage of infant formula have you asking what's going to come next? What do you know that 100% of our nation's supply almost is produced outside the United States, mostly in China and India? If we can't control our own domestically produced baby formula, what about the life-saving medications produced overseas? Many experts predict if there were a supply chain disruption in the pharma industry, pharmacies in America could run out of most antibiotics in a matter of weeks. Thankfully, there's a service, and I've used it myself, to help you get ready. Have you heard of the Jace case from Jace Medical? It's a pack of five different courses of antibiotics you can use to treat a long list of bacterial illnesses. You get at least one Jace case for every household. You got to do it. JaceMedical.com. Go there now. Use the code word Lars for $10 off. That's code word Lars for $10 off at JaceMedical.com. JASE Medical. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Conspiracy Theory Thursday, and I'm always glad to welcome back my friend Seton Motley, who's the president of Lusk Government, and he's writing about the, I guess badly named in this case, Government Accountability Office. How are you doing, Seton?
Doing well, sir. How are you?
Not too bad. I want to know, before we get to the GAO, could you tell me what you think of today's Supreme Court ruling? Because I was thrilled.
Well, yeah. Look, we play these games in D.C., you know, they play these games in D.C., you know, the Second Amendment, shall not be infringed. You know, the right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. That's pretty straightforward. What it says is, if you look up infringe, it means imposed upon.
Right.
And you can't impose upon it in any way. And, you know, you got Joe Biden lying about, you couldn't own a cannon at the time of the Founding Fathers. The hell you couldn't. A bunch of people own cannons. you know, anyway, I'm very pleased. You know, early on I was writing about the 6-3 majority and saying it wasn't a real majority, but lately they've been ruling 6-3 on a lot of really important stuff.
Well, in some cases, you look at it and say, how could you imagine? I mean, even John Roberts, who's kind of squishy by my read, how could he say, no, it's okay for New York to effectively say you can't carry a gun outside your house and say your Second Amendment only applies inside your house. Now we can apply that to the First Amendment, too, and say you can only practice your religion in your house. You can only engage in free speech in your house. Yeah, that'll work out really well.
Just what a moron Sotomayor is talking about, the separation of church and state. That was in a letter from Thomas Jefferson to the Danbury Baptists.
Yep.
It's not in the Constitution. They debated it. Jefferson wanted to insert it in the Constitution, and most of the rest of the Founding Fathers said that's stupid, and so it didn't go in. All the First Amendment says about churches, the government can't come in and say, you're Protestant, you know, you're Episcopalian, everybody's Episcopalian. That's the extent of the First Amendment's prescription on religion. It's the state can't make you practice a religion. Other than that, you can do whatever the hell you want.
All right, let's take a moment at least, because you wrote about it for Less Government. The Government Accountability Office has now kind of thrown accountability right out the window. What's going on?
Well, no, in defense of the GAO, they're the ones that came along after the fact and said, you spent all this money on infrastructure, and you don't have a plan for any of this infrastructure. They were specifically looking at the $65 billion for broadband. You and I have talked about this. The government is awful and has been awful at spending money on connectivity to the Internet for 25 years now. And they jammed through $65 billion, and the GAO comes along after the fact and says, well, we interviewed a bunch of the spenders, and none of them have a plan for how they're going to spend this money. And, of course, this has been going on for decades. The government has been spending money for decades on Internet connectivity. And the GAO is now coming out in 2022 and saying they've never, ever had a plan with any of the money they've spent going back decades. And that's a little disappointing.
I just don't understand why, when we have so many examples in the private sector of Internet and on Internet in particular, I think the government's bad at all kinds of technology. Almost every kind of technology it touches seems to turn it, you know, from gold into dross. But even having said that, on Internet, they're particularly bad. You and I both always refer to the, I think it was Provo, Utah, that spent, tens of millions of dollars.
Utopia.
And sold it for a dollar to somebody saying, take this thing off our hands. Yeah. And they managed to do something. Why don't we just keep the... And keep the government away from this stuff as much as you possibly can, and say, if you want something done with technology, you need to have the private sector do it. Now, if you want to, if you feel the need to incentivize them in some way, I'm still not crazy about subsidies, but if you really decide this really needs to be done, but nobody is going to pay to have it done, well, then maybe it doesn't need to be done. I mean, I would actually make that argument, and I'm sure somebody will say, oh, there are things, you need to have broadband. If there's demand for broadband, a private sector provider will provide it.
If there's enough demand to fill out an area, then somebody will fill out an area. This is what we talk about with fake energy versus real energy. The fake energy has to have tons and tons of government subsidies. All the oil and gas needs is to get the government the hell out of the way. That's the difference. If it's a good idea, no government money is necessary. No one needs to subsidize ice cream.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say,
can you imagine how much oil drilling we can? Because Joe Biden is running around going, well, they've got 9,000, like there's 9,000 wells ready to have the pump jack start. And he's wrong. It's 9,000 vacant pieces of land that all take federal sign-offs.
They're playing a similar game to what the Obama administration did at the border. They kept stopping people at the border, and then they would brag about how many people they stopped at the border, but then they let them into the country. So they'd say, hey, we stopped, 1.2 million border stoppings this year. Yeah, but you let them into the country. Stopping them and giving them a sandwich on the way into the country is not what we had in mind by stopping them. And they're issuing these leases, but then they're making it impossible with all the environmental reviews to actually drill where the leases are permitting them to drill. So there's all kinds of ways they can block. They're ringing up the tally on the leases and saying, hey, we've done all these leases and more than Trump. But if you're going to block him some other way, the leases don't matter at all.
No, and to the issue, back to the issue of broadband, I've got a couple of friends who kind of live in the boonies, one in one area, one in the other. And one of them was here the other night because he's a small businessman. He owns a small engine repair. And he said, I'm way the heck out of town. And he says, so power is tough, water is tough, all this stuff. He says, but he solved the problem with Internet. He put one of those Musk dishes on his roof. And I mention it from time to time because I've got one of them, but I'm not getting paid by Musk. I bought my own dish. And so if the private sector is willing to do all this stuff, why do we want the government doing the old-fashioned route? Seton Motley from Less Government. Seton, it is always a pleasure to have you on the program. By the way, speaking of technology, I am a small business owner, but even if you're not, if you've been to the grocery or hardware store, you know America has major supply chain issues. And in times like this, businesses that succeed, they're the ones that are thinking forward. One of the best ways to stay ahead of the curve is use technology your customers use every day. And that's where Podium comes into play. Podium gives your business the tools to compete with the kind of convenience offered by big businesses. Podium lets you communicate with your customers via text message. Now, that's something most people use dozens of times every day. Podium is just so convenient and works for basically any business, from plumbing to healthcare to IT. Podium helps customers communicate their needs, pay their bills, get their receipts, and a whole lot more. One jeweler sold a $5,000 ring through his website, then coordinated curbside pickup via text all through Podium. One dentist collected a bunch of his old bills and got some money. See how Podium can grow your business. Watch a demo today at podium.com/Larson. That's podium.com/Larson. Podium, let's grow. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's Conspiracy Theory Thursday. That's what we've called it for a good long time, and you're invited to the conversation. We supply honestly provocative talk for the United States of America, and I'm glad to have you with me. If you want to jump into the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here every single day. And of course, tomorrow, First Amendment Friday, we open up the phone lines to every subject. If you want to jump in, though, it's 866-HEY-LARS, and naysayers always go first at 866-439-5277. Emails all come right to me, not to anyone else. talk@LarsLarson.com. And if you want to vote in our Twitter poll, let me get to that in a moment. Should we abolish the 4th of July, as so many people on the left seem to want? We're going to get into that. Should it be okay for pro-abortion protesters to storm the Wisconsin state capitol, but when pro-Trump protesters do it over the election, it's somehow wrong at that point? What does today's Supreme Court ruling against New York City's anti-Second Amendment laws when it comes to concealed carry, what does that mean for the rest of the country? And take just a moment to vote in our Twitter poll. The question, and I think there are a number of sheriffs around America who are doing exactly what Tony Mace is doing. Tony Mace is the sheriff in Cibola County, New Mexico. And he said, I'm not going to enforce the red flag laws. He says somebody hasn't even committed a crime and you're taking their personal property. And I would add to that, without due process. Should elected county sheriffs in America, when states pass red flag laws, should they look at those laws and say, nope, I'm not going to enforce that one violates the constitutional civil rights of my residents, the people who voted for me. Today's Twitter poll can be found at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com, and always brought to you by AMAC, the Association of Mature American Citizens. AMAC has the conservative values I believe in. I joined the group and you can too. It's easy. Just go to amac.us or call 888-262-2006. AMAC's better for you and better for America. Now, because we have a naysayer, we always go to naysayers first. Fred is on the line. Fred, you heard that Twitter poll and you heard how I would answer it. I would say if you're an elected county sheriff and you see a red flag law that clearly violates the Constitution, it's not just an option for you to say, I'm not going to enforce it. I think it's incumbent on you, if you're going to live up to your oath, to support and defend the Constitution. You're a naysayer. What do we disagree about?
So thanks for taking my call, Lars. Appreciate what you do. Agree with you about 85% of the time. The main issue I have with sheriffs deciding what laws to enforce and whatnot is that they're not the authority on what the law is. They take an oath to uphold the law as currently written. The biggest objection I have is this is the reason the Defense of Marriage Act got killed by the Supreme Court, is because Eric Holder unilaterally decided he wouldn't argue the case. And that's why we have gay marriage. It's just because Eric Holder.
Well, except that, Fred, the Supreme Court heard from both sides in Obergefell, and they heard many what they call amicus briefs, so friend of the court, were filed. So it's not as though the court was unaware of the issue or unaware of the arguments on both sides. There are a lot of things I'd blame Eric Holder for, among them the fact that he was found in contempt of Congress but never actually punished. But you're telling me that if a sheriff looks at a law passed by the state legislature, passed by the county commission, and says, I know that law is going to violate the civil rights of the citizens it's imposed on, but my job is just to follow orders and not use any discretion at all?
I think if it's clear, like the case you talked about in the military, an unlawful order, I think if it's clear, yeah, you need to step up, to stand
up. But, Fred,
up to
the
that.
Reason I offer that but up, you don't really where, do no, Fred, hold on. Really. Hold on.
Yeah, go ahead.
Where, go ahead. Even in the My Lai massacre, there were service members in Vietnam who were told by their commanding officer, shoot those people. And your commanding officer has given you an order. I think in every case where somebody in the service says, sir, I'm not following that order because it's clearly an unlawful order, that private or that lieutenant or that corporal or sergeant is not a legal expert, probably not a military legal expert, and yet they are called upon to make that decision. When is it ever clear that it's an illegal order? Because in the military, if your commanding officer says, shoot that guy, your commanding officer may have reasons. Or if he says, drop some shells on that hilltop, you know, to use your mortar, use your howitzer to drop some shells up there. And you're supposed to decide, no, what the boss is telling me to do, what my commanding officer is telling me to do, is clearly illegal. I don't know that there's ever a case where it's clearly illegal.
Well, the military has rules of engagement for the servicemen, and you know, shooting civilians is clearly against those rules of engagement.
If the civilian has a suicide vest on, you shoot the whether they're in uniform or not.
Sure.
You don't think our guys have shot people with suicide vests on who were civilians? They were also terrorists, but they were civilians. So if your boss says shoot that guy, and he has a suicide vest on, it's the right call. If he's just a civilian who didn't deserve to be shot, then it's murder, isn't it?
Yeah, I agree. So
okay, so let's go back to the sheriff, though. If you have a sheriff and he says the rule you want me to impose is going to take away the civil constitutional rights of the citizens in my county, should he go ahead and just say, boss, I was just following orders?
So, yes, I actually do, because it's unclear. There are circumstances where people's constitutional rights are taken away for various reasons. People put in prison and so forth.
Well, no. When you're put in prison, you're put in prison through a process where you're accused. It goes to grand jury. They bring an indictment. You're put on trial. You're represented in court. You get to confront your accusers. You get to call witnesses on your behalf. The person who's subject to a red flag law gets no due process at all. I think that's the problem. And I think some sheriffs are well aware of it. Fred, you're a good naysayer. Thanks for the call. There are so many things to do during every summer. We want as much free time as we can ever get. So if you're a business owner like me, the last thing you want to do is sit there and sort through tons of candidate resumes while you're trying to fill a job when you'd rather be at a backyard barbecue. And that's why you need ZipRecruiter, to find the great candidates. ZipRecruiter does the work for you. Try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/Lars. ZipRecruiter uses powerful technology to find and match the right candidates with the jobs you have. You review those recommended candidates and find the best candidates to apply. And ZipRecruiter has all the tools to filter, review, and rate those candidates. 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate the very first day. So soak up all that summer has to offer and let ZipRecruiter do the work for you. Ready for the website? It's ZipRecruiter.com/Lars. That's where you can try it out for free. That's ZipRecruiter.com/Lars. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Pleasure to be with you on a Thursday night. Coming up, now that we have Juneteenth, a lot of folks on the left say we don't really need the 4th of July, Independence Day. We're going to talk about that coming up next. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. We've talked a lot about the crowd in America who are the Blame America crowd, and they've been around for decades and decades. They don't seem to like America or what it stands for, and now they seem to have a new cause. I have never said that Juneteenth should not be a holiday. And in fact, I've said celebrating the Emancipation Proclamation's arrival in Galveston, Texas, even 2 years after its signing, seems like an appropriate thing to mark. But does that mean it becomes America's new Independence Day, supplanting the 4th of July, its true Independence Day? I don't think so. Stephen Rabb is joining me now, the author most recently of a best-selling book, The Founder's Speech to a Nation in Crisis. Mr. Rabb, welcome to the program.
Nice to be here, Lars.
Is this a serious movement? Because I'll tell you that I'm a little reluctant to quickly judge things, because about 2 years ago when the knuckleheads were saying defund the police, I said, well, nobody's going to take that seriously. That's the craziest, most dangerous idea. And of course, Stephen, I was completely wrong. I thought nobody could take it seriously except all the folks who run the big liberal cities of America.
Right. Well, the Juneteenth and the 4th of July battle is serious. And the reason is that it is just a microcosm of the bigger battle, which is the 1619 Project versus the 1776 Project. So for all in America, and if you look at the sales of the 1619 Project, it's astounding. It's bestseller. It's millions of people who have bought in entirely into that revisionist version of America in which we are just a slave-holding, hateful country, right? And
yeah,
that's how they have framed the entire history of America. In fact, that's all they see in America. And so they, even Juneteenth, they've actually corrupted. You described it well. It should be a celebration. We should all be able to come together and say, this is an emancipation. Let's celebrate that, or the 13th Amendment, and say, thank God we came together, united, to end slavery. It was all of us who did this, and that should be a celebration. In fact, the Declaration of Independence was the pivot point of humanity, in which for the first time people started to see the equality of man. All men are created equal. Coming from that document, that spirit is what the next 20 years after the Declaration, seven states ended slavery. It was that evolving and growing spirit in America which ultimately ended slavery. Started with the Declaration of Independence, ended with the Civil War, sadly, tragically, painfully, but it ended that, and it took all of us for that to happen. And yet, it's politicized, it's used as a weapon against conservatives, against patriots, and that's why we have to be careful with Juneteenth. It ought to be a pure, good thing, but it has, like so many of those institutions, been corrupted by the left, and now is used as a hammer to beat down America.
Maybe I'm just too, I mean, there are times I feel like a cynic, but there are times I'm overly optimistic. But I look at this and I think, hold on, didn't they decide, hasn't it been essentially decided that the 1619 Project was, to use the common term, academic crap, that it was, or if you want to be more polite, academically flawed? Why is it just selling to people for whom this is the confirmation of their opinion, if not the confirmation of historical facts?
Correct. They live in a victim world, right? They have to keep the left in victim mindset. It is how they control the left and keep them fired up and animated and voting for them. And so the narrative is that, yes, America has always been racist, and here's our history behind it. And yes, everything that happens in America today is from white privilege and white supremacy, and that is how you can keep a hold of a person, is to keep them in fear that there is a racist under every rock who in the next moment is going to come and get you if you don't vote for us, the protectors. And so it's that very cynical framework is why they have to go against the 4th of July, which, as you and I both know, is what was a beautiful and amazing part of not just American history, but world history. And they have to celebrate 1619 Project, and they know they can't do both. We don't celebrate 1619 Projects, but we do celebrate emancipation. We do celebrate the progress we have made as a nation. They cannot. They cannot celebrate both. They only can celebrate one. They have to paint America as mostly ugly. And we stand back from the tapestry of America and say, my gosh, what a beautiful tapestry, great country this is, even with its imperfections. They look at it.
It's an exceptional country. I'm talking to Stephen Rabb, whose most recent book is The Founder's Speech to a Nation in Crisis. This is what I don't understand, and how the people who are painted as victims want to be, I mean, I guess you'd have to want to be a victim, or you feel as though, because so many black Americans going all the way back to just after the Civil War, they didn't look at it as I'm a victim. They looked at it as, here's an opportunity. Right. And I mean, I don't know, a decade ago or better, you know who C.J. Walker was? You ever heard that name?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Now,
one of the
see,
first
most people.
In America.
Yeah, the first black millionaires in America right after slavery. Well, how'd she do that? Sold hair care products door to door before she became a millionaire and I had a car and, you know, employed a ton of people and all this. And you go, how come I've never heard that? And I've asked black teachers, do you teach about her? No. I said, do you know about her? Yes. Oh, I know about her. And they're proud of that. But I said, why don't you tell the kids in school that? Well, because it runs against the conventional wisdom that we're all victims. Why, if I'm a victim in 2022, how could I explain the fact that this woman, you know, after the end of the Civil War and slavery and Reconstruction and all the troubles that came with it, this woman went out and didn't say, I'm a victim, somebody needs to provide for me. She said, I've got an opportunity. Let's go out. And she went to town with it.
Well, that's right. And the community was growing and we were evolving and civil rights movement was positive. And then Martin Luther King, and we have this, you know, the I Have a Dream and the content of your character, and we're going to get past this. And we had come so far. And then the left took that narrative. And now they essentially rejected entirely the Martin Luther King message of content of your character, not the color of your skin. And they have turned that around entirely, where it is entirely about the color of your skin. And it, in fact, has nothing to do with the content of your character any longer. They reject his whole framing of this, and that because that is going to get better and better, that narrative would actually unite and heal our nation, which means they no longer could use it as a political narrative in order to acquire power. And when you have to keep the crowd riled up and in riotous format, this create a mobocracy in which we have got to keep this it boiling high, like we saw summer and a half ago. We have to keep that temperature high because it is the only way that can keep people fired up to vote for their party. And yet, I believe it is catching up with them. I hope you agree, Lars. But I think it is catching up with them, and there is a great unmasking that is happening of the Democratic Party and of the left, and we're watching it happen right now.
I think they're all going to be hoisted by their own petard, blown up by their own hand grenade. Mr. Rabb, it's a pleasure to have you on. We'll have you back. His book is called The Founder's Speech to a Nation in Crisis, Stephen Rabb. Mr. Rabb, I really, really appreciate it. By the way, does the high price of CBD have you rationing at home or maybe just doing without? You shouldn't have to live that way. Get the relief you need right now. Go to genericcbd.com. They sell premium CBD for less, a lot less. You want an example? A leading brand of CBD salve costs about $50. At genericcbd.com, it's on sale, $19.95. The amazing CBD muscle and joint cream I've been telling you about lately, you'll see similar cream selling for up to $80. And that's if you can find it. At genericcbd.com, it's in stock and on sale for $29.95. That's a $50 savings. They have incredible prices on all their CBD products, but you're not going to find them in a store, just not yet. You can only get them at genericcbd.com. Give them a try. You might be shocked at how much you save. That's genericcbd.com, your number one source for generic CBD products. Genericcbd.com. These products and statements have not been evaluated by the FDA. These products are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease or illness. And you're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. San Francisco has a school called Lowell High School. It used to be regarded as one of the best schools in America. And yet, all of a sudden, about 25% of the kids in that school in San Francisco are getting D's and F's. And if you wonder what changed, well, what changed was Lowell High School used to be based on merit. That is, it's a public high school, but you got in because you took tests and you showed that you were academically ready for that kind of high-level work. And then San Francisco went woke. And as usual, when you go woke, you go broke. They changed from a merit-based system where you got into the school by showing you had your academic stuff together. It changed to a lottery system where it was so fair for everybody. We'll just let people in. We'll pick them at random. Of the 620 first-year students admitted through the lottery, almost 25% got at least one letter grade of D or F in that semester. Well, guess what happened? Wednesday night, the San Francisco School Board voted 4-3 because they've had a major change in their school board, and they said, you know what? We're going back to the merit system. And I figure Lowell High School is going to get fixed up. Now, the problem is for those kids who were picked by the lottery, dropped into a situation that they were not ready for, doesn't do them any good at all, does it? But it's maybe an object lesson for schools all over America. There's nothing wrong with judging people based on merit. Now, let's go. I've got two naysayers, so I'll take the one waiting the longest. Thomas, welcome to the program. What do you and I disagree about?
Yeah, I was calling about the Twitter poll you discussed with regard to, you know, how sheriffs should interpret the Constitution. And I think it's really kind of ironic that your last guest, Mr. Robb, is discussing what our founding fathers had thought about our Constitution. And to me, you know, one of those founding fathers was John Adams. And he said, we are a country of laws.
Nation of laws. Yep, not men.
Yeah, pardon men. And so if we follow the rules, and I mean, even your intro, like the intro to your program says, can't change rules in the middle of the game. If today's decision had been decided by some sheriff down in the state of New York, it would have never been issued today. And it's a good decision. We should have it that way. Because judges in the United States decide whether or not something is constitutional or not.
Well, let me ask you a question, as lawyers like say, an aid of an objection. Why do we have elected officials take an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the U.S.? Because if the job of being a sheriff or a mayor or any other elected official is just to look at the rule book, it's kind of like going to work at a company where they say, here's the company manual, follow the company manual. If that's the case, if all you're doing is whatever they write down in that book, whatever the legislature or the city council or the county commission or the Congress writes in the book, you do whatever's in the book, why would you need to worry about somebody supporting and defending the Constitution? All they're doing is following whatever order is given to them in the book.
No, actually, they're following the laws of the United States. And where, you know, something is...
Well, that's what I'm talking about. But, Thomas, you missed the question. If you say, I do whatever the book tells me, the book meaning the book of laws, the revised statutes of your state, the U.S. code written by the Congress, if all your job is to follow the rules that are written in the book by the Congress and the legislature and the courts, then why would you need to take an oath to support and defend the Constitution? You never consider the Constitution. You just do whatever you're told to do in the book, in the rules.
You know, let me address that. I think you framed it the wrong way. You support and defend the Constitution of the United States within the framework of our country. And in our country, again, like I was mentioning before.
No, it doesn't say that, though. That's not what the oath says. The oath very clearly says, I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States. Now, if you're supporting it, why do you need to even think about the Constitution if you say, if it says to do it in the rule book, in the statutes? The laws. So in various states, they're either called the revised code or the revised statutes or the U.S. code. USC is the laws written by Congress. If all you're doing is following those rules, why do you even need to think about the Constitution?
Well, we do have to think about the Constitution. So as we follow the rules that we have that are, you know, implemented by the legislature, and you know, proper under our judicial system, Article 3, whatever the state, we have to follow those within the realm of the Constitution.
Oh, hold on. I think you've reached, but you just reached, Thomas, you just reached the point that, Thomas, you just reached the point I've reached. So when you come to that point where this says the statutes tell me to do this, but the Constitution is telling me that's going to violate the rights of my citizens, which one do you do?
Which one do I do?
If you have a conflict, if the law says you should go to a man or woman's house and take their guns, in this case, red flag laws, because a judge told you to take the guns, and the law says the judge has that authority. And you say, well, this man hasn't had any due process. That seems to violate the Constitution. If the law book you're following conflicts with the constitutional right of due process, which one do you favor?
I favor that what the courts have indicated that's constitutional or not. And if a red flag law,
the courts haven't, example, the courts have not, even the Supreme Court has not evaluated red flag laws per se. So if U.S. Congress right now is going to pass a law and they are going to tell state legislatures, we want you to pass red flag laws, which require the violation of due process. So when a sheriff finds there's a law that tells me to go violate this man or woman's due process rights, do you follow the law or do you follow the Constitution?
You follow both. You follow
but
the
you
law.
Can't. They conflict.
You can't.
You cannot.
Absolutely, Bart. If you let me finish, I'll explain how.
Sure. Go ahead.
If that sheriff or that law or that individual that's been harmed by the lack of due process feels that that's happened, then they can challenge it in the court.
Now, I'm not talking about what the victim of – I'm not talking about the person it's having enforced. You are the enforcer. You're the sheriff. I'm not talking about what the guy or gal you're doing it to can do. They can seek a remedy, and 5 years from now, they may get a court to say, sorry, we violated your rights. But you're the sheriff, so you arrive at a point where you say, I'm being told to walk into somebody's house and take their stuff without due process. That's what the law says. The Constitution appears to say nobody from the government can take a person's property without due process. If you're given two conflicting instructions, which one do you follow?
I like I said, Lars, I follow both. Sheriffs don't decide what's constitutional or not.
Police officers engage in discretion all the time where the rule says I should do this. For instance, you stop a man who's running his wife who's about to give birth to a baby, and you say, my job is to stop him here while she's in labor in the back seat and write him a ticket and run his background. Do you say, you know what, that one doesn't make sense. I think I'll put on the lights and siren and escort them to the hospital. And you say, well, where does it say that in the law? It doesn't. It says it in your oath to do the right thing. But I appreciate your call. You're a good naysayer. Does the current nationwide shortage of infant formula have you worried about what's coming next? Do you know that almost 100% of our nation's supply of antibiotics is produced outside the United States, mainly in China and India? And if we can't control our own domestically produced baby formula, what about all the life-saving medications produced overseas? Many experts predict if there were a supply chain disruption in the pharma industry, well, pharmacies could run out of antibiotics in a matter of weeks. Thankfully, there's a new service to help you get ready for that event. Have you ever heard of the Jace case from Jace Medical? The Larson household has them. It's a pack of five different courses of antibiotics that you can use to treat a long list of bacterial illnesses, including UTIs, respiratory infections, sinusitis, and skin infections. Every household needs at least one. My household has a number. Go to jacemedical.com and use the code word Lars for $10 off your Jace case. That's code word Lars for $10 off at Jace Medical, J-A-S-E, jacemedical.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Well, things move at lightning speed because just last week, I had John Solomon on, the guy who breaks all the big news at justthenews.com, and he was telling me, well, we can't tell you that it's Stephen Colbert just yet, but it was his crew caught at the Congress without authorization, without badges and everything else, and he couldn't give me the name. And then literally within minutes at justthenews.com, out comes Colbert's name, and of course the rest is familiar to us because it's a liberal comedian named Colbert. His crew has, you know, it's no big deal. Adam Schiff invited them in, all the rest of that stuff. I thought I'd ask John about that before we got to the Second Amendment ruling today. John, how are you?
I am well, and sorry to do the big tease last week, but about a couple minutes after I got off air, both CBS and Capitol Police gave us a statement where we could actually go live and acknowledge it. But we always want to do our reporting and never get ahead of the facts. So I apologize for the tease, but no, you guys had a sense of what was coming.
Don't apologize, John, because there have been times I've told people, they say, why don't you put that story on the air? I said, there's one more piece I need, and I won't do it without that one more piece. And you're not just trying to be dramatic or something. You just right? say, this. You got to do it. You got to be first, but you got to be right, but you got to be right first. Yeah, exactly. So I want your take on what the Supreme Court did today and the fact that the left seems to be losing its mind, including people like Keith Olbermann saying, this is proof we have to dissolve the Supreme Court.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. Listen, this is a man, Joe Biden, who said that he would honor the institutions of government. He'd restore trust in the institutions of government. That's part of his pitch when he was running. And we're going to bring normalcy back to Washington. Today, after the Supreme Court ruled, after the Constitution was exercised exactly the way it was supposed to be, Joe Biden tried to undercut the legitimacy of the Supreme Court because he didn't like the way a ruling came out. He went back on his own word, his own promise that he would honor the institutions. This is dangerous language. When a president starts to undercut the legitimacy of the other branch of government, we head towards a constitutional crisis. I don't think he did the country a favor today. Most of the people I've talked to today have also said that, which is they were struck that someone who promised to uphold the institutions would make such comments and cast doubt on the constitutional system of government we have. This is a prelude to what's likely to come if an abortion ruling comes down and Roe v. Wade is changed or overruled in some fashion. The president has now given license to his party, to liberals, to call into question the legitimacy of the Supreme Court. That doesn't help America at all.
No, it doesn't, especially when in the last year and a half, this guy has written executive orders and then had them thrown out by the courts, and he doesn't like that. He appears to be willing to break the rules when he wants to, and yet when the ultimate court, the last court of appeal in the land, the Supreme Court says this is the rule, then he goes out and undercuts them deliberately. And he knows, probably to a fair certainty, that most of the reporters are not going to say, as you did, Mr. President, you said you'd honor the institutions of government, and now you're doing exactly the opposite. They're not going to call him on his hypocrisy, are they?
Yeah, no, it's pretty remarkable. It's actually stunning. And, this has been a presidency that has been filled with contradictions. And I think in the last week, we've seen several of them again. Hey, I want clean energy. Oh, wait, I'm not going to use American clean energy, but I'll go to Saudi Arabia and ask them for their dirty oil. And when I say dirty oil, Saudi production is just higher in carbon emissions, higher in pollutants than American. Well, that's just a fact from the Energy Information Administration. So the president has these contradictions. I'm going to uphold the Constitution. I'm going to uphold the institutions. Oh, wait, I'm going to attack one of the institutions because it didn't go my way. When the courts ordered him to reinstate Title 42 and to return the Remain in Mexico policy that Donald Trump had put in, you know what he did? He just created a bunch of exemptions to thumb his nose at the court. Yeah, I have put these documents out. People can see it. They just created exemptions to the whole rule so they could say, well, Your Honor, we're abiding by the law, but we made a whole bunch of exemptions, which basically got the law. This is not a man that actually has upheld the institutions he said he would honor when he took office.
Well, and I wonder, John, because you and I have had this conversation, I think, for the last couple of years. People have asked me before, well, what can a court do if it orders something done and then the parties it orders say, we're just not going to do it? And I said, well, ultimately, they've got the federal, I guess they could send the federal marshals and say, you go and shut this down or seize this or close that off or do, you know, in other words, there is an enforcement mechanism for the courts, isn't there?
There is. It's called contempt of court. We've seen it over the years. You see the contempt of Congress citations against Steve Bannon and Peter Navarro. There is a similar mechanism in the federal court system, and that could trigger a bunch of things. Now, the chance that the marshals are going to go pick Joe Biden up, pretty slim, I think. But you listen, it would create a constitutional crisis. If the courts said Joe Biden is no longer abiding by our ruling, we don't believe this is the legal way to follow our order, many things could happen. First, the Joe Biden himself could be ordered to pay a fine. The administration could be ordered to pay a fine, which means taxpayers would cut it up. Or another thing could happen, which is there could be a referral to Congress. Hey, your president, the third branch of government, isn't paying attention to the second branch of government. You guys should consider the constitutional remedy for this. So there are a lot of different ways that this could play out. And this is interesting. I've been interviewing a lot of the attorneys general who brought the lawsuits that have secured these rulings. And let's keep in mind, Joe Biden's record in the federal courts has been very bad when it comes to his executive orders. He's lost on COVID. He's lost on the border. He's lost on many different things. These attorney generals say, listen, we're getting to a point. I think I had Ken Paxton from Texas on saying, we're getting to a point where a contempt request may be one of our next things, an enforcement mechanism or contempt request. So the attorney generals are even beginning to think this way because they've watched months go by and the situation really hasn't been followed. The instructions of the court, at least according to the attorney general, haven't been followed.
One thing I wanted to ask you about, John, because I recall that when the gay marriage decision was made in Obergefell, it was either that same day or within 24 hours, people showed up at courthouses and such and said, okay, we want to get married. It's now legal. And they got it in most cases. I think there was one case in Kentucky where the county clerk fought it. Are we going to see the same kind of thing in New York and these other states that have improperly denied the civil rights of Americans for decades where they say, okay, the court has ruled, let's get busy and let's get it done? I suspect they won't.
That's a great question. Well, what will happen, I've interviewed a lot of lawyers today, and as I best understand it, as a layman here, is that by Monday, this ruling will go to all the courts that have suspended cases that flow from this argument, and then the courts will be given the instruction of the Supreme Court, and they should rule. Now, it could be some courts won't follow this. They'll try to keep, you know, get overruled by an appellate court. But I think the next thing is, how do states like California and New York that don't want to abide by this, what games are they going to play? How are they going to change the permitting system to acknowledge the Supreme Court's rule, but to see if they can get away with something? That's what a lot of Second Amendment lawyers are looking for, sort of a permit with a couple of twists on it to make it harder still. We'll see, but this is a very clear ruling. There's very little ambiguity. The right to bear arms isn't just to own an arm in your home. It's also the right to carry it in public, and I think that is an unequivocal ruling. It's a very clear, simple, straightforward ruling.
It's fantastic. That's John Solomon. You can find what he does at justthenews.com. John, it's always a pleasure. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Tell Alexa to play The Lars Larson Show.
Shocking. Absolutely shocking that they have taken away our right to have reasonable restrictions. We can have restrictions on speech. You can't yell fire in a crowded theater. But somehow there's no restrictions allowed on the Second Amendment.
That is Kathy Hochul, the accidental governor of New York City, reacting to today's huge and I would say positive Supreme Court decision. A win for the Second Amendment, a win for the firearms rights of every citizen, which have been under attack lately, if you haven't noticed. And we're going to talk about that for a bit. I invite your phone calls. It is Conspiracy Theory Thursday. So welcome to the Lars Larson Show. And if you want to sound off, it's 866-HEY-LARS. Naysayers go right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. You can send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com and vote in our Twitter poll. We'll get to that in a moment. It has to do with red flag laws, another attack on the constitutional rights of Americans. Now, about that Supreme Court decision, Kathy Hochul says, why, you can't have any limits on the Second Amendment. That is actually factually wrong, and she knows it's wrong, or maybe she's not bright enough to actually understand it. We keep explaining to the confused liberals and progressives what the Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution actually means. And the folks in New York passed laws that clearly violated the U.S. Constitution, and that's what the Supreme Court decided today. Our God-given rights include the right to own guns. Can government put some limits on the actual exercise of that right? Kathy Hochul is right. You can't shout fire in a crowded theater. There can be limits on every one of the Bill of Rights, and anybody who says otherwise doesn't know constitutional law. Because if it weren't true, you could go out and say things that would incite a riot. And yet virtually every city in America, including New York City, has a limit on free speech. It's a law called inciting to riot. It can be a crime if you're charged with it. It isn't charged very often because it doesn't happen very often. But the anti-gunners try to say that the Second Amendment only covers a militia, and that ain't true, and the Supreme Court has said so, or that only the guns in use when the Constitution was written, and that isn't true either. In fact, if you could hold all of the constitutional rights to the standards when the Constitution was written, then it only talks about free speech and free press. There was no TV, there was no radio, there was no internet back when they wrote the First Amendment. And yet the First Amendment does apply to the modern versions of free speech. Or that they say only the guns that our government masters deign to allow us to have. Well, unarmed people are subjects. Armed people are citizens. Over the last 20 years, the Supreme Court has helpfully provided some clarification of the limits the Second Amendment puts on the government. Just remember, the Second Amendment is not a grant of rights. It is a limitation on what the government can do to take away our God-given rights from citizens. Well, just hours ago, the court issued its latest missive to America's rabid anti-gun activists. New York City tried to tell citizens that they could only own guns inside their homes. That is wrong, and the court now says so. In the Big Apple, if you are not rich or politically connected or both, you can't get a gun carry permit. So effectively, New York City was saying, own a gun if you want to, a pistol or a rifle, but don't take it outside your house. Is that what keep and bear arms actually means? The Supreme Court sensibly said, no, that's not what it means. It also means that poor people, including a lot of people of color, then the most likely group to fall victim to criminals, could not protect themselves. That's what New York City was saying. Today's decision by the U.S. Supreme Court ends all of that. The Supreme Court says you have a right to carry a gun outside your home. In other words, to keep and bear arms. The mayor of New York City, Eric Adams, reacted with hyperbolic rhetoric. Listen to this.
We worked together to limit the risk this decision will create once it is implemented. And we cannot allow New York to become the Wild Wild West.
The risk of becoming the Wild Wild West? You got to be kidding me, Eric Adams. Arming law-abiding citizens threatens to create a Wild Wild West? I'm thinking that arming the law-abiding poses a threat, all right. It poses a threat to every dirtbag criminal out there. Criminals like the ones in Chicago and New York and other cities around America who know that most of the law-abiding in at least the big blue liberal cities have been disarmed. That makes them easy pickings for the bad guys. If all of a sudden the good guys, the law-abiding, are armed, well, if the bodies of criminals start to pile up on the streets of the formerly anti-gun cities like New York City, I would have to say that's a good start. Now, let me give you some pieces of the decision, because once again, Justice Clarence Thomas, one of the 6-3 majority in this decision, he had it dead on. He said that New Yorkers who want to carry a license or get a license to carry a handgun in public have to show proper cause. In other words, you've got to show that your life's already been threatened before you can go get a permit. Generally, it means in New York City, you have to be very wealthy and very politically connected. As Thomas wrote, when the Second Amendment's plain text covers an individual's conduct, the Constitution presumptively protects that conduct. The government must then justify its regulation by demonstrating that it's consistent with this nation's historical tradition of firearms regulation. The Supreme Court decided New York City's rule was not. And in another opinion in which Kavanaugh and Chief Justice Roberts agreed with Justice Thomas, they said the ruling does not preclude some state and local regulations. Some regulations, gun ownership by felons or the mentally ill, or banning the carrying of firearms in sensitive locations. As Roberts and Kavanaugh wrote, properly interpreted, the Second Amendment allows a variety of gun regulations. States can make applicants apply for a license. They can undergo fingerprinting, a background check, a mental health records check, training in firearms, and laws regarding the use of force, among other possible requirements. And yet, this craziness of saying you just can't get a permit unless you're Michael Bloomberg, a rich guy and a politically connected guy, or other rich and politically connected people in New York City. Paul Clement, the lawyer for the group that brought the lawsuit, said his clients were looking for nothing more than what their fellow citizens in 43 other states in America already enjoy. Carrying a firearm outside the home is a fundamental constitutional right. It is not some extraordinary action that requires an extraordinary demonstration of need. Can you imagine if I got called into court and said, hey, Lars, before you say all those words on the radio, you have to get the government, get a permit from the government. Oh, and by the way, you have to show a need to have to say those words before you can exercise your First Amendment freedoms. Or imagine the government saying to you, you need to go to church on Sunday or synagogue on Friday night or Saturday. No, you have to show us you need it before you can actually exercise your rights. Can you imagine anything so crazy as that? Glad to be with you and glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Conspiracy Theory Thursday. Always glad to get your calls, too, at 866-HEY-LARS. And naysayers always go first at 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. Should a religious school be forced to support groups within that school that are actually working in contravention to the religious beliefs of a private religious school? I thought we'd talk about this issue, and it's an interesting one, with Rabbi Yaakov Menken, who's managing director of the Coalition for Jewish Values, the largest rabbinic public policy organization in America. Rabbi Yaakov, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me again.
Would you mind telling me what's, and my audience, what's going on at Yeshiva University in New York City?
Well, Yeshiva University just got a judgment against them, of course, from a particular judge in the New York State system that said, responding to a lawsuit from a group that wished to form as an officially recognized student group at Yeshiva University as an LGBTQ club. Now, of course, Yeshiva University, being a Jewish rabbinic school or associated with rabbinic school, is obviously of the Jewish religious variety. But nonetheless, back in 1970, they chartered themselves as a secular school in order to receive certain funding the government will only give to schools it deems secular, which, if you're watching, you know, just a week ago, or a few days ago, actually, the Supreme Court declared potentially unconstitutional. So I don't think, in Yeshiva University's defense, I don't think that they even imagined in 1970 what being secular would entail in 2022. I don't think they could possibly have foreseen that. But the dean of the rabbinic school associated with it said with some prescience in 1970 that this is a really bad idea.
He did. So he anticipated that this might be the result, that when you start taking money from the government, you promise we're going to be a secular school, that you could end up with problems. The thing I don't understand is, why would somebody whose life, you know, the way they conduct their life is not in accord with the religious beliefs of a school, why would they want to be a student or a teacher or in any other way associated with the school if the school doesn't hew to the same values they do? I've never understood that.
Yeah, my son did not think about applying to Baylor University. You've got a point.
Well, and, you know, Rabbi, there was a case, I don't know, about a decade ago. There was a lesbian couple. Fine, okay, it's their life. I'm not running their life. I don't want the government to run their life either. They wanted to put their kids in a Catholic school. And then they complained that the Catholic school said, we don't approve of your lifestyle. You're a couple. You're a lesbian couple. And I wondered, well, if you're a lesbian couple and you understand the Catholic Church is, you know, you love all the sinners, but you don't love the sin, and you can say we disapprove of your lifestyle. You knew that when you walked in the door. Why did you come to a place that you knew was somewhat antithetical to the way you conduct your life? Why not go to any other school that you could go to? And of course, they brought a lawsuit demanding that the religious school change its practices rather than simply self-select and go to a different school.
There are really only two options here for the students at Yeshiva University who did this. One is that throughout high school, in the middle of pride parades and all the celebration of this lifestyle that's going on right now, they had absolutely no clue that they were gay as they went through puberty and adolescence and checking out everybody and et cetera, which means that it's not at all the innate character trait, the element of a person's identity that they claim it to be, that that's simply not the case. It's a choice. It's a desire. It's something that arises in people, but it's not an identity characteristic, which completely contradicts the entire message. Okay, that's possibility number one.
Right.
Possibility number two is that they went to Yeshiva University with an agenda to force a Yeshiva University to say there should be no refuge from this nonsense. No, there cannot be any place in America outside perhaps a house of worship where you're allowed to say, we don't believe in your lifestyle. You have to have it, even at Yeshiva University. So either they say it's not an innate characteristic at all, or they went there to celebrate their agenda and with an axe to grind. And by the way, the fact that the judge is herself a member of the LGBTQ Law Council of New York and got a coveted, highly approved rating, and rare highly approved rating, from LGBTQ New York Vote, that kind of tells you something.
Well, and Rabbi, it seems to invite kind of what I think what the lawyers call a moral hazard. You've now created an opportunity, and I would compare it to this, although it's not in the religious lane. If I went to a bunch of my conservative friends and said, let's get a few million of us, let's join the Sierra Club and turn it into the biggest advocacy group for drilling for oil in America. And they'd say, well, why would you go to a group that doesn't believe in drilling for oil and want to change them? You say, because then I'll basically wipe them out as what they are, what the Sierra Club, you know, stands for. I'm not a member of the Sierra Club, obviously. But why would I want to do that? So that I can destroy other institutions that are part of people's beliefs, if not closely held religious beliefs, then at least philosophical beliefs, and say, we're going to have these marauding bands of people running around saying, let's get into an organization and we'll change the nature of the organization where we're all done. We can walk away and leave the wreckage behind us. That's what it seems like to me. It invites that kind of behavior, doesn't it?
It is a mob mentality. It is dominating the left. It is this concept. I mean, of course, as a Jewish person who cares about Israel, you kind of reminded me of this so-called idea of a Palestinian right of return, which is that any Arab whose great-great-great-grandparents ever step foot in British Mandatory Palestine has a right to live in Israel, which, of course, means we demographically overwhelm the Jews, and presto, we don't have a Jewish state anymore. We have no opportunity for anybody else who's different. Well, that's exactly what they're trying to do to the school here, and that's what you see the left doing in America and many other areas. What you just described regarding Sierra Club, I don't think that's such a theoretical. We've seen organizations taken over by woke radicals that didn't start off that way, who have living donors who say, why did I ever give this organization a penny when this is what they're supporting now?
I've noticed that, too, because, Rabbi, I have some friends whose families have given a lot of money to foundations and such, and they say, why is this foundation so different? You know, in other words, if the people who founded it and gave the money to start it and the people who continue to support it, why is it so liberal and left? And you say, because they, you know, what happens is they, the other side, comes in, takes over, and says, we don't like the philosophy of this organization, so we're going to change it. Well, why not just start your own organization? They say, well, we already have LGBT organizations. We want to take over all the other ones. And I've got gay friends who say they hate what this whole LGBT crowd is doing. They resent the idea. Well, that's Rabbi Yaakov Menken. He's the managing director of the Coalition for Jewish Values. Rabbi, it's always good to have you on the program. Hey, does the high price of CBD have you rationing or just doing without? You shouldn't have to live that way. Get the relief you need right now. Go to genericcbd.com. They sell premium CBD for less, a lot less. Here's an example. A leading brand of CBD salve costs about $50. At genericcbd.com, it's on sale, $19.95. The amazing CBD muscle and joint cream that I've been telling you about the last few weeks, you see similar cream selling for up to $80. And that's if you can find it. At genericcbd.com, it's in stock and on sale, $29.95. That's a $50 savings. They have incredible prices on all their CBD products, but you're not going to find them in any store, at least not yet. You can only get them at genericcbd.com. Give them a try. You might be shocked at how much money you save. That's genericcbd.com, your number one source for generic CBD. Generic CBD. CBD.com. These products and statements have not been evaluated by the FDA. These products are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease or illness. We'll be back in just a moment. I'll get to your calls. And if you're a naysayer, you go right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And as you know, on this program, naysayers go to the head of the line, although we haven't had any naysayers recently. Maybe they've just lost their nerve or something. So many things are going south on them. I got up this morning early and got cleaned up, and then I put on one of my favorite Second Amendment shirts, not knowing that the U.S. Supreme Court was going to come down with a hugely consequential decision, although it seemed like kind of an obvious one to me. New York City had told its citizens for years, if you want to have your Second Amendment rights, you can have them in your house or in your apartment or your condo or your co-op, but you can't carry your gun outside. No, to get that, you need a big pile of money and or big political connections. Otherwise, you can't have a carry permit. That went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court has said, hey, New York, that's unconstitutional. Knock it off. And, of course, the liberals are going absolutely crazy. So I thought I'd talk to Tom Gipping, who's deputy director of the Ed Meese Center for Legal and Judicial Studies and a senior legal fellow at Heritage about this. Tom, I hope you don't take this personally, that I would rather talk to somebody from Everytown or one of the rabidly anti-gun groups, but they won't talk to me, Tom. So I thought I'd talk to you and get you to give my audience an idea of where this takes us now.
Sure, and I would gladly step aside if that opportunity presented itself, but as with the upcoming decision regarding abortion, liberals, you know, they say that they object to the decision, but they never point to where in the actual opinion explaining that decision there is a problem. Look, Justice Thomas in the decision today pointed out that both sides agree that the Second Amendment gives you the right to possess a firearm for self-defense, even outside the home. The what makes this New York law unique, I think only five or six states try to do this, is that they make you not only meet certain objective criteria for a license, but they make you prove that you must, that you have a, quote, special need for a firearm for self-defense. Well, it's not a right if you have to convince some public official that you have a special need for it. Imagine if we did that for the First Amendment or the Fourth Amendment, or imagine for the liberals, what if they did that with abortion?
That you have to prove imagine that.
Special need. I mean, liberals would go absolutely insane. So it was a very common sense, straightforward decision. A right is a right. Second Amendment gives law-abiding citizens the right to possess a handgun for self-defense, and you don't have to make some special showing to some bureaucrat to exercise that right.
I'm talking to Tom Gipping from the Heritage Foundation. So, Tom, it turns out that the very thing the libs thought was going to give them the greatest justification to argue for more gun laws actually worked against them, because didn't the court members in this big opinion, and, you know, they had concurring affirmations of the, I think I've used the wrong word, concurring majorities who wrote different opinions. But they said, look, Buffalo, New York just had a shooting. And clearly the restrictions on guns in New York did not constrain the killer in that case one little bit.
Well, that's a good example of where, in addition to is this a right or isn't it, you have the practical question of which is really more of a policy-oriented question, and that is, do any of these gun control ideas, and the same ones come up all the time, do any of them have any hope of improving the situation? And the New York State and Buffalo is the clearest example where they have those laws. It's not speculation about what if they did. They have those laws. And obviously, they don't stop these kinds of shootings. Again, law-abiding citizens have a Second Amendment right to possess a firearm for self-defense. That's been true since before the Second Amendment was even part of the Constitution. I really want to emphasize what the court did, which is this right of self-defense predates the Constitution. It's even more important than rights that appeared for the first time in our Constitution. And this isn't the first time the Supreme Court has said so. This time they said, and we mean it.
And by the way, Tom, one of the things that's getting under my skin already, in the last couple of hours, I've seen headlines that say Supreme Court expands gun rights of Americans. Now, I think it's a know-nothing headline writer, but they didn't expand anything. All the court said was, you've always had that right, and New York unconstitutionally restricted it. Am I right?
That's right. Any court, and the Supreme Court, I think Justice Thomas explained it in his opinion today. They do two things when they have a decision like this. They interpret and they apply, whether it's the Constitution or a statute. The interpretation of the Constitution is fixed. The application to different circumstances is what it can be more challenging. That's what the court did today. They didn't change the meaning of the Second Amendment. They didn't change the breadth of the right that you and I have to defend ourselves, but they applied it to the particular law in New York State that require that where the government really decides whether you have a need to exercise your Second Amendment right. That's what the media gets wrong, and that's why you see misleading headlines like that.
Tom, let me ask you a question. When they decided gay marriage, the so-called Obergefell decision, my recollection is within either hours or at most a day or two, there were gay marriages happening in all these states around America where it was illegal up until Obergefell was decided. It might have even been the same day. Now, in this case, when the court says to New York, you have unconstitutionally constrained the civil rights of your citizens, do we see the same kind of instantaneous reaction that citizens can now go to the state of New York today or tomorrow and say, hey, I want a permit and I no longer have to show you a need?
Well, we'll see. I mean, remember in the civil rights movement, after Brown versus Board of Education, a lot of schools in the South and states in the South found ways of dragging their feet and still resisting, you know, recognizing people's rights. You can bet that liberals, especially those in states like New York, are going to do everything they can to prevent people from exercising the right that the Supreme Court today vindicated. And that's why, you know, we have to be thankful to those organizations and plaintiffs who are willing to step up and go all the way to the Supreme Court, because they're defending the rights of all of us.
Well, I heard Eric Adams, this joker who's the mayor of New York, saying, well, we've got to prevent this from becoming the Wild Wild West. I'll tell you what, Tim, I live out west, and while it's not the most conservative place in the world, we have fairly good laws on concealed carry, and not a week goes by when you don't hear about a homeowner killing somebody who came to the house to rob or hurt that person, and they're justifiable. So I'm kind of hoping, and that's Thomas Jepping, the legal fellow of the Heritage Foundation, deputy director of the Ed Meese Center. Back in a moment. What I'm about to say is urgent. 98% of our antibiotic supply chain is produced overseas. If that supply chain gets cut off, experts predict that pharmacies could run out of most antibiotics in weeks. Preparedness isn't just about food storage. Are you prepared with antibiotics if that happens? Many common infections can quickly become deadly if not treated by antibiotics. Have you heard of the Jace case by Jace Medical? It's a case you can order online that contains 5 life-saving antibiotics prepared to treat infections. Just fill out the online form for review by a board-certified doctor who's going to ensure the medications are safe and appropriate. Every home needs at least one Jace case to care for yourself and loved ones should the antibiotic supply chain get cut off. Having antibiotics available for things like supply chain, pandemic, natural disasters, even family outdoor adventures. Go to jacemedical.com right now. Promo code Lars for $10 off. Jace with a J, medical.com. Jace, J-A-S-E, jacemedical.com. Order now and be prepared. I'll get to your calls. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
Would there be any place for fossil fuels, including coal and fracking, in a Biden administration?
No, we would work it out. We would make sure it's eliminated.
No more drilling on federal lands. No more drilling, including offshore. No ability for the oil industry to continue to drill, period.
I guarantee you, we're going to end fossil fuel.
What about, say, stopping fracking and stopping new pipeline infrastructure?
New pipeline, exactly.
No more, no new fracking.
We are going to get rid of fossil fuels.
I've argued against any more oil drilling or gas drilling on federal lands.
No one's going to build a coal-fired plant again, and we're going to get rid of the ones we have now.
Have a transition from the oil industry, yes.
Would you be willing to sacrifice some of that growth, even knowing potentially that it could displace thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of blue-collar workers in the interest of transitioning to that greener economy?
The answer is yes.
Now, that is Joe Biden when he was a candidate for president. Now that gasoline has hit a price that is, well, it just dipped right below $5 nationwide average per gallon. Diesel's north of $6 a gallon. And all of a sudden, Joe Biden has a political problem, and he's begging just about everybody around the world, except, of course, American companies, to drill for more oil, produce more oil. He's telling the oil companies, you've got to refine more gasoline and diesel. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Pleasure to be with you. And if you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here. In fact, we're going to talk to a naysayer here in just a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. And welcome back to the Radio Northwest Network, serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho for the past 22 and a half years. I'm glad to have you with me, and if you want to send me an email, talk@LarsLarson.com is where you go. If you want to vote in our Twitter poll, it's @LarsLarsonShow. And then this week, Joe Biden decides, well, I'm in trouble on gas prices and diesel prices. My party is going to lose the House and the Senate, and we're already on track to lose the presidential election, and that's 2.5 years away. What are we going to do about this? So Joe comes out and says, how about a 90-day suspension of the federal gas tax? As I've said all along, both when we expected him to do it and when he finally did it yesterday, that is, he did it in the sense that he asked the Congress, and there's no guarantee the Congress is going to go along with it. I said, well, look, I don't want to turn down any help to Americans who are paying these punishing prices right now. But if 18 cents a gallon reduction is going to do the trick, I don't think that's the case either. But like you said, any little bit might help. Well, it turns out that even his friends, his closest political allies, believe this is ridiculous. Barack Obama said, for us to suggest a little bit of relief for 3 months is real relief, we're not tackling the problem. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, very showbiz, okay? Let's just do something, there it is. But it's not necessarily landing in the pocket of the consumer. Steny Hoyer, the House Majority Leader, I've not been a proponent of a gas tax holiday. I don't know that it gives much relief. Joe Manchin, skeptical. Tom Carper, short-sighted and inefficient. Richie Neal, representative in the House. There's no guarantee that any sort of suspension of the gas tax will be passed on to consumers. And he was asked, is the savings really going to flow to the consumers? Peter DeFazio, member of Congress, although he's quitting at the end of his term, suspending the federal gas tax will not provide meaningful relief. And then when it comes to his energy secretary, Jennifer Granholm, she proves once again, there's a reason we say she's not the sharpest tool in the shed. Take a listen.
The national security, the energy security implications of Putin's war cannot be overstated. The geopolitical realignments that are happening as a result are momentous.